Chapter 6. The Rat Man of Treviso. Two tiers of tall Gothic windows were ablaze with candlelight as the Lauritsens and I approached the landing stage of Palazzo Pisani Moretta. The carnival ball was already in progress. Costumed men and women stood on the balconies above us, drinks in hand, looking out over the Grand Canal, and the glimmer of lights reflected on the night-blackened water. "The facade is late 15th-century Gothic," said Peter. "Notice the especially fine examples of Quatrefort tracery above the windows of the first piano nobile. They're derived, as you've no doubt already surmised, from the Doge's palace." Peter was wearing a long black cape and a black mask. "Trespassing," said Rose. "Think of it. How horribly embarrassing for Woody Allen. But Casson was quite right to do it, you know, if he really means to find out what happened at the Fenice." Rose's hair was combed in an upsweep, with a string of pearls laced through it. She wore a bejeweled black satin mask and an evening dress that was a column of black chiffon. "He's one of the few honest, incorruptible prosecutors we've got left. A white knight! I just pray he doesn't suddenly self-destruct like all the others." "Then in the 18th century," said Peter, "the strong-willed Chiara Pisani Moretta redecorated the palazzo at enormous expense, all while laying siege to the courts, hoping to have her brother declared illegitimate so she could spend his share of the family patrimony on the palazzo as well." Rose lifted the hem of her gown in preparation for stepping onto the dock. "But, I mean, one does feel sorry for Woody Allen," she said. "First his jazz concert gets burned out of the Fenice, then he's arrested for dropping by as a gesture of sympathy." Rose became distracted by a man in a green mask who was alighting from one of the water taxis ahead of ours. "Oh, Peter, look, that's Francesco Smeraldi." Then, turning to me, she said, "He's a poet nobody reads, because as soon as he finishes a poem, he locks it in a bank vault. He used to teach writing and poetry to schoolchildren until it was found out that he..."
No, Rose, you're wrong," said Peter. "That's not Francesco Smeraldi at all. It's..."
"Well, how can anybody tell with that mask he's got on? All I can see is a mouth and chin. Anyway, whether that's him or not, Francesco Smeraldi did fall out of favor when it was discovered he'd taken a group of children on a tour of Lewes to read the graffiti."
At the water entrance, we stepped onto a carpeted platform, flanked by two flaming torches, and walked into a cavernous entry hall with large, gilt-framed lanterns hanging from dark beams. A monumental staircase at the far end led to the first piano nobile, and a vast center hall with ceilings richly frescoed in the Rococo style. The room was illuminated by 9 huge glass chandeliers and 6 sconces, all of them aglow with masses of tall, white candles. Tonight, every room in the palace was lit exclusively with candlelight. The crowd numbered several hundred. The din of their voices had the excited, high-pitched sound of people enjoying the release from stiff formality that masks and costumes conferred, even though most of the people were recognizable despite their masks. There were kisses on both cheeks, overheard snatches of conversation, "skiing in Cortina, up from Rome, bellissimo," and waves of the hand to friends glimpsed across the room. We stood at the center of the room, attended by white-jacketed waiters circulating with trays of wine and pink Bellinis. The Bellinis were authentic. Tonight's party was being catered by Harry's Bar, the establishment that invented the drink, a combination of Prosecco and the juice of fresh white peaches.